I never really thought like cooking was my thing, you know?
My grandma quite actively
forbade me from going into the kitchen. She used to say like she didn't want me to get used to being in the kitchen.
Welcome to Crazy Smart Asia, the unexpected stories of Asia's disruptors. I'm your host, Chong Xiaowei. Every week, we talk with a young leader about the crazy smart approaches they're taking to achieve success and tackle some of the biggest issues facing Asia today. Most people you find in the food and restaurant business have a short fuse, love to swear, and run off of pure adrenaline and plenty of yes chefs. In stark contrast, this week's guest provides a refreshing antidote to your stereotypical chef entrepreneur figure. She didn't even cook much growing up. Her grandmother wouldn't allow her in the kitchen. She's a culinary anthropologist focused on bringing back Asia's indigenous plants for people to grow and enjoy today from their balconies. And based on her belief that the produce we grow and eat tells the story of who we are, she's built a business around communal eating. On reimagining Asian food culture, here's my conversation with the founder of Brunch Bandits and Singapore Seed Exchange, Nithya Lila.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Nithya, welcome to Crazy Smart Asia. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me, Xiaowei. Like, it's been a while since we last chatted. I think it was at the Tatler Summit, right?
Yeah, it's been a while, a couple of months. We're going to kick off with a round of quick-fire questions to kick off our conversation. So the very first question is, can you describe what you do in one sentence?
Yeah, so you wear so many hats, right? So I would say I'm a culinary anthropologist. I kind of work within the intersection of culture, of heritage, of sustainability, but really through the medium of food as a storytelling medium.
Mm. And what would you say is your favorite meal or favorite dish?
Favorite dish? The thing I miss the most when I'm away from home is your kuehs, actually. Kueh salat in particular.
Nice.
That's what I miss the most. It's very hard to find outside of Singapore and Malaysia.
Mm. And what would you say is your biggest guilty pleasure?
McDonald's? No, I mean, I think it doesn't matter how much you kind of, I work in food, I'm into native edible plants and all of that. But like, I think as an 80s child in Singapore, the filet-o-fish and the chicken nuggets are, they have a kind of a nostalgic grip on you, right? No matter where you go. So I would say that's my guilty pleasure.
I'm totally behind chicken nuggets. I can have it every day. And final question, what is your best and worst habit? So that's two questions in one.
I would say procrastination. And then I would say the positive word for it is kind of waiting for things to fall into place until it feels right. Kind of going with the flow, you know, like not pushing sometimes. Mm. Waiting for it to feel right. Yeah, so I'd say like two sides of the coin.
Yeah, I think procrastination can also come from taking your time to think about how you can be more creative, right? It's the creative process. That's why you procrastinate on something. Okay, so just to set the context for our listeners, what was growing up in Singapore like for you and how did your experiences get you into food?
So I sometimes share, like I grew up in Singapore in the early 80s. And when I share with some of my friends or, you know, even like people who are slightly older than me, they think like I must be living in a weird pocket in Singapore, right? Like I had a very natural kind of upbringing in terms of access to nature. Like kind of, you know, I saw banana being brought home in the hole with the flower at the end, for example.
Wow.
Or my granddad would come home with a whole soursop that he picked on his walk back home. So there were still these like fruit trees in Singapore, and having access to that, seeing like You know, the mango trees used to have like a little bamboo pole hidden behind the trunk with a little hook on it, put by the community, and all the uncles and aunties would go and harvest the mangoes when they came into season.
Wow.
So this was still kind of happening. And I had access to that because of my grandparents and by extension, their friend. There was one, this is probably, I mean, it's very illegal today, but somebody gifted my granddad a baby monitor lizard.
What?
So I came back from school. I think I was primary 3. And there was a rice sack in the bathroom and it was wriggling when I went into it. And I had no idea what it was. And my granddad was like, yeah, we're going to cook this for dinner later. Somebody gave it to me as a present.
Yikes. You know? Okay. Was not exactly expecting that. So,
and seeing that, you know, being like kind of it being prepared from the whole process, right? Both horrified and completely intrigued because you don't really see that in Singapore often. So I think this slice of Singapore that was fading rapidly, it was like a transition generation where, you know, there were still fruit orchards, there were still things to forage, and that knowledge that was getting passed down to you because you have grandparents or great-grandparents that had come as immigrants to Singapore, carrying that knowledge of growing up in an agricultural, very bountiful natural environment. So that kind of primed me, I think. Like, I will still try anything once. So I don't have any kind of weird barriers to what I would eat and not eat. I have things I like, but I will try anything once. Like when we filmed Edible Wild in Guangzhou, we went to a restaurant that's been operating for like, you know, multiple generations, and they were serving worms, for example, sea worms, you know, and like while the rest of the crew was like, I'm not going to eat this. For me, it was, you're respecting someone's heritage, right? And it's something that has resonance to their culture, and people are traveling to this restaurant to eat these worms. So you eat it and you appreciate it. You might not like it. You might not try and recreate it when you're back in Singapore, but that kind of openness and a curiosity and a respect and seeing that food is not just sustenance, but it's also kind of a nourishment and sustenance beyond the physical, right? It sustains your soul, it sustains your heritage, but it can also help you evolve that journey of where food is meant to go.
Mm. And how much has the environment the environment that you grew up in, how much of it has it changed already?
Oh, like I started Brunch Bandits really because like when I came back to Singapore, you know, I think once my grandparents passed, that the huge communal meal that I remember from my childhood, you know, big pots of food were usually cooked. And there was always like an open house in the weekends and you could come and you could eat. And there was always people coming in and out. And when you come back, and usually I think I was 25 when I came back to Singapore at that time, and your friendship circles are people like you, you know, your age group generally. And I think the importance of intergenerational conversation, eating, sitting next to people you might not always like, right? Is something that a lot of us lose that access to as we get older. We only hang out with people we like. I mean, you have your colleagues and you have your work environment, but in social settings, we're usually hanging out with people we like, and we lose that importance, the ability to communicate, to understand, to find similarities with someone that's different from you, which you get in big communal dinners. You know, you don't like all your relatives, right? Or your extended relatives, but you're there, they're socializing, you're eating together. And so I started Brunch Bandits because that was starting to disappear. So I wanted to create a communal table. I wanted to give access to kind of plants that, to use plants in food that I had grown up with and I had seen being used in other cultures while I was in London, that I didn't see in Singapore. So I did anthropology, and that's kind of when I started, I guess brunch pandas in its very infantile form started, like kind of cooking in dorms, because we had kind of students from all over, and cooking, sharing, learning. That's kind of how it started. You know, I was working at the London Farmers Market in the weekend. I was helping out at an allotment at Battersea. And we're doing this little cook-togethers, you know, like, it's weird now that I think about it. Like 20 years ago, avocados were not common in Singapore. And
now they're everywhere.
I remember they're everywhere. Like when I first went, 2002, I don't really think I had an avocado. Like, it wasn't something you saw on menus. But then over there, the West Indians, you know, it was part of Caribbean cuisine. It was super normal and it was being sold everywhere. And a friend came to visit me from Singapore and she was like, oh my God, a couple of years later, right? Like 2005. And she was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing avocados everywhere. And it's a pound for 3 avocados. You know, she's like, in Singapore, like, it's so expensive. So we got some. We went back home and she proceeded to make a milkshake with the avocado. And I was horrified, right? I was like, what are you doing? Like, this is meant to be in a salad. What are you doing? And she's like, this is all the rage in Singapore at the moment, you know, avocado milkshakes. That's how it kind of got introduced into Singapore around 2005. So it's really about like food trends. It's about things that we take for granted now, like kale. You probably didn't have it. I think the first time you probably had it in Singapore was probably about 10, 15 years ago. I remember, like, for me, kale was like a 1 pound vegetable that no one wanted to eat, right? It was in the supermarkets. It was like a kind of like a weed. They were trying to like hype kale up. Please eat kale, you know, locally grown kale. And no one wanted to eat it. Like 20 years ago, kale was bottom of the barrel, you know. Avocado was more relegated to Caribbean, East African cuisine because they had it growing there. It wasn't yet in your salad bowls or seen in that way. And I think having seen this trend and also having friends, I was secretary of my Afro-Caribbean society, believe it or not, while I was at university. There weren't any other Singaporeans at my university, so I got co-opted, right? So I learned a lot about the cuisine from there. And I think that's kind of where it started, like food as a tool to find commonality, right? Like delicious food transcend any bias.
Yeah. I think when you first moved to London, you mentioned that you were homesick, right? Even before you started your little brunch club at university, you were already cooking your grandmother's recipes for your friends. Do you want to share a little bit more about that?
So the internet was there, but it wasn't something you really had on your phone. You couldn't really Google recipes. And I was telling all my friends in my dorm, guys, I'm going to cook you something from home. And kind of thought I had overpromised because I had no idea how to do it. So I remember going to like Brick Lane, you know, where they sold all the spices and stuff, and asking the guys at the shops, like, okay, what do I put in chicken curry? How do I do, you know, like, kind of, they were like pointing me in the right direction. So I bought all the ingredients. It took us hours to put it together. I went with my friend, and she's half Zambian and half French. So I dragged her along and we were like trying to figure all of this out. And she came back and she kind of, we cooked together, right? And I cooked like a chicken curry and I made raita and like biryani rice. And I cooked from memory, you know, of how it was supposed to taste. Like, I added stuff as it went along. It wasn't formulaic. I wasn't following a recipe. And it got to a point where I was like, this tastes of home, or, you know, close to how I remember it. And my friends loved it. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe I'm not quite so bad at this thing. I can recreate a dish that I tasted, you know. Because, I mean, like, my only experience really with cooking growing up was, like, experimenting on my little brothers, right? I would make things and my poor little brothers would have to eat them. And they were, you know, little brothers being little brothers, they would eat it and then completely diss it right after. So I never really thought like cooking was my thing, you know.
My grandma quite actively forbade me from going into the kitchen.
She used to say like she didn't want me to get used to being in the kitchen, that you shouldn't think that's a woman role, I guess.
Right.
Cooking, you know, the being in the kitchen. So I never was really allowed in there, really, other than to do experiments or, you know, pluck vegetables by the side, peel potatoes or something in the corner, but never really in there. So this was my first time cooking it. And I was also surprised by what I thought I missed. You know, I barely kind of, we would eat Indian food once in a while, maybe once a week when my grandma cooks like a curry or something, right? But we would eat everything else throughout the week. And I was surprised that the kind of the first thing I cooked was my grandmother's curry, for example. And I think my mom sent me a care box my first few months at uni. And it was very funny because she put in kuih makmur, a big tub of kuih makmur, you know, the peanut stuffed kuihs that look like a leaf. And she sent me Marks and Spencer's blueberry jam. I was like, you
which
do
you
realize
can find
I'm
in London.
Exactly. But it was the things she thought that I liked, you know, and she was sending this like little care package for me. So I think it's always, food has been a way to show love. Food has been a way to remember people who have gone. But I think for me, really, it was just like, I feel a lot of us are stuck in our own bubble. We're surrounded by people who think like us, who talk like us, who look like us, who hang out in the same places as us. And it was always for me to use a table as like an equal platform where anyone who is interested in trying this food come and talks to the person next to them.
That's exactly what Brunch Bandits is, right? I mean, that's the narrative that behind the brand. You guys also work with local farmers, right, to cook the food.
Yeah, you see, so that's the thing. Like, you know, people ask me sometimes, like, how did you become a culinary anthropologist or what's your trajectory and plan? And it was all so organic, you know, like it was to almost like to feed a gap or a response to something that I saw was not there, or kind of a very like a sinking of places and ideologies that happened at the same time. So I came back to Singapore. I'd gone back and forth, and this was after I was working in Saatchi, in London, and then I like, okay, I'm done with you know, corporate. I'm just gonna try and do my own thing for a bit, and see where that goes. So I was back in Singapore, and it was about 2013, and my friend was like, hey, you know, there's this place on Rowell Road. Somebody's trying to set up a farm in the shop house, and I was like, okay, sounds cool. let's go check it out, you know. And so we went. I just said hi. Bjorn was there. So it was Edible Garden City at that time, in Rowell Road, trying to set up a microgreens farm. The second floor was like a space for people to come and do creative things together. And they had a kitchen. I wouldn't say a fully functional kitchen, but they had a kitchen. And Bjorn was like, hey, you know what? Like, if you want to do anything here, go ahead. You know, just use the space.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I was like, okay, I really want to try and cook the cuisines that I miss, you know, like West Indian, Kenyan, Ethiopian, featuring working with kind of people from those countries who are in Singapore as well, to kind of show how really multicultural the fabric of Singapore is.
Yeah.
You know, so we did that, and I would get scotch bonnets and habaneros and sawtooth coriander from Edible Garden City, which they were growing at that time on the side. And I think it's been one of, like, I think my Singapore, like my journey back in Singapore, especially with Seed Exchange, Branch Bandit, even Edible Wild, was really kind of, it began there.
So for our listeners who thought that the food industry is only about opening restaurants or being a chef, how would you explain your profession to them?
I think maybe 10 years ago in Singapore, it would have been something that was harder to comprehend. But I think now, if you're a restaurant that wants to get a Michelin star in Singapore, you need to have a story. I think you need to have a cultural narrative, I think. I think it's quite interwoven into how we see fine dining in Singapore at the moment. So where I stand is really about that food is not just something that's there at the table, right? We talk about the social political implication, the economic historical narratives for a dish to be in front of you and what it means.
Yeah.
So I was giving a talk and, about food as aspiration. All right. Food is aspiration. It's a marker you wear of what you can afford, who you've been, where you want to go. And I think a lot of the time we forget that, like what it indicates. It's a kind of soft messenger of who we are, actually.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that in between. I work with farmers, I work with chefs, I work with restaurants. We try, for the restaurants who are trying to incorporate a bit more of the cultural narrative into their cuisine, we try and help them as well. It's friends helping one another, and it's very kind of, for me, as also as someone who likes to go to restaurants and dine out, it's also been really fun for me to see that changing landscape where the story has become more important, where chefs are not just thinking about skills and techniques, but also about kind of who they are and what they want to say with their food.
You also received a grant from the Ministry of Sustainability and the Environment in Singapore to build Singapore Seed Exchange, right? I think the goal, obviously, for you is to encourage more people to start growing and also using indigenous plants. Can you share a little bit more about that project and how the idea even came about and what you want to achieve through it?
Yeah, I mean, I think Seed Exchange was a very natural evolution, right? Of someone that was cooking and trying to talk about culture, talking about kind of different ways, food concepts, but using local produce, and then realizing that in the last 10 years, that access to these plants was something that you only really had if you knew somebody, right? It was a very personal exchange. It was, you could be in the urban farmers group, but you would have to go down to their house or to a place or know somebody. You have to spend time. And I think I really wanted, like for me with food and with plants, with growing, is diversity, equity, and access. Those are my three key themes. How can we create more equitable access to diverse narratives, perspectives, and also seeds? Seeds are like the very essence of life, right, in a lot of ways. So I think as indigenous plants and native edible plants have become more popular, they are something you see more and more on fine dining restaurant menus. And also urban farming has become very on trend at the moment.
Yeah.
It's also to make sure that access to these plants is something everyone can have, right? And to build a community around where, so imagine I grow Thai basil, and my neighbor grows like bird's eye chili, and the other person is growing lemongrass. if we just swap, we can possibly create some kind of a dish, a foundation for a dish together, you know? So it's a kind of like, I don't think in Singapore, it's ever about growing quantity. It's about kind of growing quality. It's about heirloom varieties. I feel we can really become archivers of heirloom varieties from the region.
Why do you say that?
Because it's like we are wealthier than our neighbors. We are more connected. And we have, I guess, a bit more access to seeing the value in this information. You know, we are that bridge between the East and the West here in Singapore. So we know that it's of value to know about indigenous plants. We can see the trend shift in the West, you know, about native edible plants, indigenous plants, regenerative agriculture, heirloom varieties. There is that shift, and it's becoming ever more important in the West. And in Singapore, we can help our neighbors. Like, we don't have as much agricultural land as our neighbors, but we can help our neighbors.
But I understand that you're also launching an app soon. Is that true?
Yes, yes. So we've been working on an app, which we realized, especially because of the kind of geographical function, which is so that if I'm in Clementi or in Bukit Timah or Pasir Ris, I can search within my area to see if anyone has seeds on offer. And that made a lot more sense as an app, actually. So we're working on it at the moment, and we plan to launch it soon. I think it's also like when we really first started it, it was just like, it was, you know, as with all of these things, it was something that I felt was like needed to be done. We started off as a non-profit because that was really the intention. It was never really seen as a for-profit enterprise. But now as we move towards it being functional, like for it to function, for it to be active and for it to be of impact, it's also about finding a way where people can use it and use it actively. And the app seems the most like sensible way forward.
Yeah. And is this going to be scalable for other countries, you think?
Oh, the intention from the beginning was really to connect across the equator. So if you go to Tanzania, if you go to Jamaica, they all grow very similar variety of the kind of plants we have in Singapore as well. So it's really to kind of connect farmers all across the equator where we have similar geographies, similar kind of weather patterns, the tropics, basically, and have them kind of exchange different varieties.
Okay. Would you describe yourself more as an entrepreneur or a culinary anthropologist? Because you're both.
It was really about creating content, making impact, creating community. Like, all our projects are collaborative. From the very beginning. So that has always been the most important. And really about the work, like creating, putting together, things coming together. And the crazier, the better. I mean, I've mellowed now, but in the beginning, you know, like Branch Bandits, it was insane. We would pop up in a kitchen that we've never used before with a team that has never worked together before, cooking a cuisine that we've never trialed before. For people that we've never fed before. You know, it was like everything that could possibly go wrong should go wrong, but it doesn't. And it's a one-off and it's memorable. I'm not saying we didn't have like fuck-ups, right? Like, I'm sure there were, but it was always memorable at the end.
Yeah.
And I don't think I can do like such cowboy things anymore. People expect me to have some level of, you know, seamlessness in the work that I do now, and I try to do that too. But the experimentation, I think that's really where I get the joy from. You know, the kind of synergy that comes when everything just falls into place.
A lot of our listeners are business leaders, entrepreneurs. Some of them are artists, creatives. So if you had one advice to people who are aspiring to do better or to start their own business, what would it be?
I think something that I try to practice is to always give more than you take in any situation, right? Like, I think if we apply that to our natural environment, to food, to community, anything, even in our company, right? an abundance mindset is key. I think if you have lack within yourself, if you feel lack, it's very hard to create a socially responsible business. Because you always feel you have to step over someone else or something else to move ahead. And I think that doesn't create a very sustainable culture moving forward. I mean, if we want a better world, I think it's so important to make sure that you do the inner work, right? And I think always know that you have enough, right? I think the you know, competing with the Joneses mindset is something that we really should leave in the 80s.
So turning 40, are there any like main focuses in your life right now? Like what are your priorities this year?
I mean, I think turning 40, I'll be very honest. I've spent my life kind of running away from accumulating material objects or responsibilities. I think as someone who moves a lot, you realize like when it comes time to pack and move, like the less you have, the better. But I think like turning 40, you know, kind of being comfortable with kind of a bit more responsibilities, creating more space in your life for cats, for others to take up space. That's important.
That sounds amazing. So this show is also all about uncovering the unexpected stories of people that we speak to. What do you think people do not know about you or find surprising about you or your journey?
The fact that it's all unplanned, possibly. To be perfectly honest, I was going to do law at university. And then like a couple of months before that, I decided I was going to do anthropology. And for the 3 years that I was studying anthropology, my mom told all our relatives that I was studying avianology about birds. she thought I was going to come back and work for the Jurong Bird Park. So that's kind of how unplanned it's all been. I've kind of done stuff that I wanted to do. But the most surprising, I would say that like I try to put up a respectable appearance, you know, to And I think especially when you work with plants, people immediately assume that you're kind of like some Mother Gaia character, right? But, you know, like if you're in fashion, you're provocative. If you're in plants, you're, you know, Mother Gaia, earthy. And I think, I was a very rebellious student, actually. Like, I was...
Share more.
I was so bored in school. Like in secondary four, I pretended to have tuberculosis so that I could miss the school on Thursday for a month until my form teacher called my mom and asked how my tuberculosis was doing. And my mom was like, my daughter has tuberculosis. I found an old card somewhere, like, and just started filling up my name and creating appointments for myself. And it passed and I didn't have to go to school. Every Thursday for a month. Yeah. I was at the old TV center, you know, in Balestier, going for my appointment. But yeah, stuff like that. Like just super random, things. I was never like aggressive or violent or, you know, I was always like the kid that just tried to like quietly get out of like going to school.
So what were you doing on Thursdays then?
Oh, so I would go to the library.
It was
very odd. Like, I would cut. So that's why I never got caught. Like, other friends, like, were playing truant and going to the mall and getting caught, right? I was going either to the beach or to the library. And
by yourself.
In my school uniform. Yeah, by myself. And no one ever called anyone on me because they were like, the girl's in her uniform and she should be at school, but she's in the library instead. So. Okay.
Were you studying in the library or reading in the library?
I was reading like Asimov novels, like the magazine collection, like sci-fi, which I loved. I read a lot of fiction and even to this day, not a lot of nonfiction, I think. So probably that's where the imagination or the kind of being creative, that seed kind of came from there, I suppose. But yeah, so I was not a kind of very conventional student. I still did okay. Like, I still did okay. Surprisingly to everyone. I was top of my class in Tech 4. I think my friends were shocked.
Wow.
Yeah. Shocked. They were just like, yeah. I had a few friends who stopped talking to me because they just thought that I had lied to them. You know, like, so I've been studying in secret.
You were fake sick, but you still topped your class.
Yeah. So I think I got away with it eventually.
Final question for today. So what's one question that you find very difficult to answer?
I think when people ask, like, especially when I have to do interviews where it's for young students, you know, like for people who want to become culinary anthropologists, or how can someone follow your career path? And I'm just like, don't. Like, there is no path, you know, like just figure out something you're good. I mean, honestly, like, I think there's this whole discussion about passion, whether you should follow your passion. Mm. And so people think when I say I don't have a plan that I followed my passion, right? I don't know if I followed my passion. I did something that I really felt that I was good at, and I was at the right place, at the right time, and I could feel that gap. I was very lucky, right? It was really a coming together of things. But my mom told me this thing. So I was working corporate and I was renting, and then when I started doing my own thing with Brunch Bandits, I moved back home. And my mom said, in 2 years, if you can't afford to pay rent, then you're not good at what you do. And I said, fair enough. Good point. And so that's what I did. So 2 years late, 2 years after, where she could never understand why I was carrying pots and pans and ovens upstairs. And she's like, why did I send you to university only for you to be doing this, like, heavy manual labor? After 2 years, she kicked me out, right? Not in a rough way. I mean, in a follow-up of the thing. And I could pay rent and live comfortably. And I was like, okay, I'm going to continue doing this. You know, it's really, really not about following your passion. It's about whether you have something to offer that other people need. And if you don't, then find something else, right? Like, that's what I would say.
All right. Thank you so much, Nathia, for joining us on Crazy Smart Asia. It's been a great, 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 great conversation.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
That's it for yet another episode of Crazy Smart Asia. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to follow us wherever you're listening to this. Crazy Smart Asia is produced by Josie Kota and edited, mixed, and mastered by Ben Beheshti. Genty's digital editor is Valerie Lim. Crazy Smart Asia is hosted by me, Chong Xiao Wei. In the meantime, do remember,
if you can't afford to pay rent, then you're not good at what you do.
See you next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.